Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, December 3, 2014, during a live telephone conference call.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Immigration, the Limits of Executive Authority, sponsored by the Federal Society's Separation of Powers Practice Group. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we are very pleased to welcome four distinguished experts, lawyers, and scholars to discuss this very exciting topic. We're going to hear five-minute opening statements from each speaker, followed by some back and forth, and then, of course, your questions. I'm going to keep their bios brief, as I could probably spend the entire hour reading off their resumes to you. But first, we're going to hear from Margaret Stock, who is counsel to the firm, the Cascadia Cross-Border Law. Then we're going to hear from Professor John Eastman, who is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Studies at Chapman University School of Law. Third, we're going to hear from Professor John Baker, who is a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center and professor emeritus at LSU Law School. And then finally, we're going to hear from Professor John Yu, who is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. So without any more ado, I'm going to turn it over to Margaret Stock. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about executive power and immigration, and specifically to discuss the actions taken by the Obama administration in recent weeks with regard to immigration policy. At the outset, I think it's important to correct some misinformation being put forth by numerous sources. There was no executive order. President Obama did not sign any executive order. Instead, he gave a speech, and his Secretary of Homeland Security issued a series of internal agency memoranda, most of which state what future agency policy should be with regard to various issues involving immigration law. Many of these memoranda, and by the way, they're all posted on the DHS website, deal with mundane matters, such as the fees to be charged for citizenship applications and the way immigration agents will be paid. Some of the memoranda deal with legal immigration and how legal immigrants' cases should be adjudicated. And a few of the memoranda deal with the Department of Homeland Security's enforcement priorities, and these are the ones that are triggering the most sound and fury. The actions generating the most discussion were the memoranda directing the immigration agencies to expand the number of people granted something called deferred action. Deferred action is a temporary reprieve from being deported. It doesn't give anyone a green card. It doesn't give anyone citizenship. It just gives a person a temporary reprieve from being deported. And the agency was directed to grant deferred action to large numbers of people who are unlawfully present in the United States today, but who were brought to the U.S. as children or who are the parents of U.S. citizens or legal immigrants. As a side note, they also have to have paid their taxes and have no criminal record and go through a background check and so forth and so on. One part of this program, the Program for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, has been the subject of various legal challenges, but none of them have succeeded to date. They failed on either standing or jurisdictional grounds. So to date, no court has ruled that there's anything unlawful about what the president did 2 years ago, which was very similar to what he just did. So today, we're merely going to be speculating about the potential legality or illegality of the latest executive actions, since we have no court ruling to look at. And my position, to make it clear at the outset, is that the president's actions appear to be legal. In fact, the president has done much less than what he could have done. I will be quoting John Yu's past writing in support of that position, but let me give you the quick summary of my argument. First, although the core of President Obama's authority to modify immigration law falls in his inherent power to practice prosecutorial discretion, which is rooted in the Constitution, the specific actions he took are justified by the Immigration and Nationality Act, a law passed by Congress, and by congressional budgeting priorities that are unique to immigration law. As I've said before, the Immigration and Nationality Act and other immigration laws are chock full of huge grants of statutory authority to the president. In my view, this makes the president in tier one of the Youngstown test with what he's doing. Notwithstanding all the sound and fury coming from the Hill this week, the Constitution and the statutes give the president the explicit authority to do what he's done. Next, The immigration code is incredibly complicated, and most of the folks opining that the president can't do what he's done are not people who have read the immigration code. If they've read any of it, they've only read selected parts of it. They read the parts that call for deporting people, and they don't read the parts that say that the executive branch can decide not to deport people, or that people who are unlawfully present in the United States can be given permission to be here by the executive branch and can be given permission to work. They also fail to explain how the president is supposed to enforce the deportation laws when Congress fails to appropriate enough money to enforce them. This is a problem in many areas of federal law enforcement. For example, right now, the tax laws are not being enforced due to a lack of IRS agents. In fact, there's a tax amnesty going on right now, and there's also an unofficial amnesty due to a lack of IRS agents to conduct audits on people who are openly cheating on their taxes. Is the president obligated to enforce all the tax laws when he doesn't have enough agents to audit everyone who's apparently violating them? Is his tax amnesty illegal? I haven't heard a single commentator complaining about it. Professor Yu has said that, quote, the Constitution's Take Care Clause imposes on the president a duty to enforce all constitutionally valid acts of Congress in all situations and cases, end quote. But we know that's not true. What about the tax and employment laws? Does the president have a duty under the Take Care Clause to make sure every employer in Texas and Arizona is appropriately classifying people as employees instead of independent contractors? We know in Texas it's very common for people to break that law. In fact, they talk about it on the radio, how they do that. But Congress has not appropriated money to hire enough agents to audit employers for these law violations, and the executive branch hasn't been enforcing those laws either. The U.S. Supreme Court reaffirmed recently in Arizona v. United States that the executive branch has broad discretion, grounded in statutory delegations of authority by Congress, to enforce or not enforce the immigration laws. And apart from his delegated statutory authority, the president has inherent authority over immigration-related matters that influence the nation's sovereignty in foreign affairs, according to the United States Supreme Court. But this is an important point to note. For decades, Congress has been delegating away its power in the immigration code, and it's done so with immigration far more than any other area of the law. Opponents of the president's executive actions don't point to the code at all. Instead, they talk about the design of the Constitution, although I would note that they ignore the pardon power, which belongs exclusively to the president. But the density and complexity and the breadth of delegation in the immigration code make all these arguments about other laws irrelevant to the debate. To argue logically and coherently, you have to point to the code. You have to look at the code where the Congress has given the president lots and lots of authority. If Congress wants to stop the president from using his statutory authority and his inherent power in the area of immigration, they're going to have to start passing legislation, something that this Congress has seemingly been unable to do. But certainly they could pass legislation repealing the statutory grants of authority that they have given the president in the Immigration and Nationality Act. They also made one of the immigration agencies a user fee agency, which complicates their ability to shut it down if they don't like what it's doing. So they could start by repealing the statute that makes USCIS into a user fee agency and start appropriating money to run it. That would give them more control over how the money is spent. They could repeal the 1986 law that gives the executive branch the authority to grant people work permits. They could repeal the Real ID Act, which says that people with deferred action are allowed to have driver's licenses. Those could be places to start. They could also pass appropriations that would allow the president to enforce the parts of the law that they like, but they haven't done that. The president could deport a lot more people and would not need to set enforcement priorities if only Congress would give him a few billion more to build detention camps, hire more federal agents to go door-to-door looking for people, and audit more U.S. employers. Congress does appear to be acting on this front. Representative Yoho is trying to get a bill passed that would mandate the deportation of every Cuban who entered the U.S. unlawfully since the 1950s. And that brings up another point. Why is there no uproar about the prosecutorial discretion the president has employed to deport millions of people? George Bush never did that. President Bush was, relatively speaking, quite lax about deporting people and allowed millions to stay in the U.S. unlawfully, including President Obama's uncle. I'm out of time, but I want to mention that Barack Obama also inadvertently fed critics by repeatedly telling people for years that he did not have the power to do what he just did. Apparently, he got some bad legal advice, which has now been corrected, and he is now more aware of the power that he holds as president. But he's not the first president to say that he didn't have the power to do something, and he then went on to do what he said he couldn't do. The first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, said in his first inaugural address, and I quote, "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so, end quote. A few years later, of course, Lincoln had apparently changed his mind and issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Presidents have often discovered that they have more power than they thought they had before they became president. Thank you.
Wow, I don't hardly know where to begin. This is John Eastman. I'll take up the Lincoln quote first. Of course, Lincoln's first inaugural was before we were at war, and the war powers, which is what was the source of his authority to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, and only in the states that were at war, was a rather different source of power. But let me go back, because Margaret has challenged those of us who have criticized the president as saying we never cite the statutory code. And if you've looked at any of my writings over the past several weeks, indeed over the last couple of years, you know that's not true. I have been citing the statutory codes at length. And there are a couple of points here to be made. First is the president's action, or as Margaret rightly points out, the Secretary of Homeland Security's actions on November 20th, were not a difference in kind from what former Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano did back in July of 2012 with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Act. Both of those, under the claim of exercising prosecutorial discretion, did two things. They declined to investigate and begin removal proceedings for whole categories of people. The November 2014 decision just significantly broadened the categories of people who are covered by that non-removal proceeding dictate. They halted removal proceedings that were already in place. Both sets of memos did that. And for those that had already gone through removal proceedings and had a final order issued, for anybody meeting the criteria in either the 2012 memo or the 2014 memo, those removal proceedings were dropped. Now, there's a significant question on whether this pushes the power of prosecutorial discretion beyond the breaking point. The Supreme Court has not directly addressed this issue, but there are hints in a couple of cases where it suggests that such a broad categorical exercise of prosecutorial discretion violates the president's take-care obligations. Heckler versus Cheney, for example, finds that judicial review of exercises of enforcement discretion could potentially be obtained in cases where an agency has adopted a general policy that is an abdication of its statutory responsibilities. And, of course, that case goes back to a much older case, Kendall versus United States, where the court said, quote, to contend that the obligation imposed on the president to see the laws faithfully executed implies a power to forbid their execution is a novel construction of the Constitution and entirely inadmissible. So the notion that we can go from a case-by-case prosecutorial discretion decision to an entire categorical suspension of the law is in my view, likely presses the prosecutorial discretion point beyond the breaking point, and those court decisions have suggested it. Moreover, the court has recognized that Congress can deal with this by specifically mandating enforcement. Now, Margaret said there's no court to have addressed this issue at all. That's not true. The Northern District of Texas, before it found that it did not have jurisdiction to continue the case, actually issued an order saying that the word shall in the relevant statutes mandated the initiation of removal proceedings for all unauthorized aliens, thus statutorily removing whatever prosecutorial discretion might otherwise exist. I think that's important. It's the only case thus far to address the issue, and Margaret is right that at the end of the day, that court held that it did not have jurisdiction because it was brought by federal employees, and their complaint had to be resolved by the Systems Protection Board instead of in the Article III courts. But it nevertheless, I think, is a significant holding of that court before it withdrew its jurisdiction in the case. So that's, I think, this broad-based prosecutorial discretion claim is a much closer question than certainly the president and his two secretaries of Homeland Security have made it out to be. But even if we accept that prosecutorial discretion is broad enough to cover here, what Secretary Napolitano did back in July 2012 and was now confirmed by Secretary Jay Johnson in the November 2014 memos is go beyond just deciding not to prosecute or not to deport, but actually convert that decision to a lawful status that violates the statutory code of the Immigration and Naturalization Act. Now, back when Janet Napolitano issued her first memo, she did not cite any authority whatsoever for her claim that applicants in deferred action would be eligible to qualify for work authorization during the period of the deferred action. There was a lot of speculation about what the legal authority for that would be. The speculation centered on a specific federal regulation, 8 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 274A.12, which authorizes work for designated classes of aliens. And subsection A10 says an alien granted withholding of deportation or removal for a period of time in that status is eligible for work authorization. But, of course, as every first-year law student knows, federal regulations have to be rooted in some statutory authority. And that regulation cites 4 statutes, none of which, in my view, provide the necessary authority for this claim of converting prosecutorial discretion not to enforce the law to a granting of lawful status to people who are unlawfully present in the United States. The closest one is Section 1324A, and that's the provision that spells out, that defines as the general rule that the employment of illegal immigrants is unlawful. And then the statute provides some very detailed exceptions to that. For example, what we call the T visas. If you are unlawfully present in the United States but were the victim of human trafficking and you are cooperating with prosecutors in the prosecution of that human trafficking crime, you can be given a T visa and a lawful permanent resident status and work authorization as a result. Very detailed requirements in all of these exemptions for when somebody can get here. Unauthorized aliens are defined. It says Section A1 of this provision specifically makes it unlawful to hire an unauthorized alien as defined in subsection H3 of this section. Now, that subsection in turn defines unauthorized alien as any alien who is not lawfully admitted for permanent residence. That would be all of those carefully wrought exemptions that I was talking about, such as the T visa, or an alien authorized to be employed by this chapter. Again, a whole set of specific, very detailed criteria that are required, or by the Attorney General. Now, this is the phrase that the President and his current Secretary of Homeland Security has glommed onto, or by the Attorney General, and then by extension, the Secretary of Homeland Security, because another statute transfers immigration duties from the Attorney General to the Secretary. And that's the only statutory hook they have. In my view, that's a very slim read for all the heavy lifting for the President basically to rewrite the entirety of our immigration law. Now, not just to decline to prosecute or deport illegal immigrants, but to grant them a lawful resident status and work authorization as well. Now, such absolute discretion, none of the pages and pages of carefully circumscribed exceptions would have been necessary because the President could have just done this whenever he wanted. And never mind that this, the more likely interpretation of this phrase, that it refers back to other specific sections and other parts of the Immigration and Naturalization Act that do give the Attorney General specific authority to grant visas for temporary lawful status, such as Section 1101A15(5), which allows the Attorney General to confer temporary lawful status on a close family members of lawful permanent residents who have petitioned the AG for a non-immigrant visa while an application for an immigrant visa is pending. So that's much more likely what it refers to. And if it is instead as broad as the President claims, then it is an unfettered discretion. We haven't had a non-delegation doctrine case in a very long time, although one is pending at the Supreme Court right now. But the court has been fairly clear that in giving discretion to the executive, there at least has to be some intelligible principle that statutorily guides the exercise of that discretion. The President's interpretation of this particular clause in this particular statute is unfettered discretion, that the Attorney General or the Secretary has unfettered discretion with no intelligible principle whatsoever just to decide to issue work authorization whenever he or she chooses to do so. That would violate the core separation of powers principle that the lawmaking power is vested in Congress and not the executive. And there's no place in the powers enumerated delegated to Congress that the court has been more consistent in recognizing it as strongest. The plenary powers over naturalization decisions that are vested in Congress by Article 1, Section 8 are unbelievably strong. And for the president to take this particular clause, which was added as part of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, without, as far as I've been able to tell, in all that voluminous legislative history, not a single peep from supporters or opponents of the law that this was going to give an unfettered discretion to the president to do whatever he wanted in legalizing status and work authorization here. It's just kind of beyond belief that that's what occurred. In fact, for over a decade, in efforts in Congress to pass a DREAM Act, to my knowledge, not a single person argued that the president already had the power to do this. Congress sure spent an awful lot of time trying to get the DREAM Act through, if in fact it was entirely unnecessary because the president already had that power. So I just don't think that little phrase does nearly the heavy lifting that the president and the secretary of Homeland Security are claiming, or that Margaret has claimed as well. And quite frankly, therefore, I think what the president has done is unconstitutional. It's lawless. And it really needs to be put in check, because we do not have a system where the president just gets to suspend the laws at his will and rewrite the lawful status at his will. That's dictatorial. It's not the representative government that we have.
This is John Baker. I begin by noting that the first two speakers took roughly 10 minutes apiece. I will try to do less than that. I want to say that Margaret Stock must be the most knowledgeable immigration lawyer in the country. I say that not just because she was the top immigration lawyer for the Army and that she got a MacArthur Fellowship for immigration, but every time I have an immigration problem, I go to Margaret to correct me, and she always does that. And I think it's important to listen to a lot of what Margaret says, because she gets on the detail of things, and a lot of times conservatives don't back up their policies with the detail. John Eastman, of course, did in great extent, right, as you've just heard. But having said that, I still do disagree with Margaret here today, and we set up the disagreement, I guess, in an email I sent to her in advance, but we didn't really discuss it. And what I posed to her was the fact that there seemed to be a conflict between part of the memo by the Office of Legal Counsel supporting the president's action and a recent decision by a U.S. District Court in New York called the Juarez case. In Juarez, there was a group of plaintiffs. It was class action by DACA plaintiffs, that is, people who have had deferred action. They brought an action against Northwestern Mutual because Northwestern Mutual has an employment policy that restricts it to citizens and permanent legal residents. And they said that because under DACA and their employment authorizations that they were being discriminated against. In the opinion, the court mentions it was only a ruling on a motion to dismiss, but the court clearly was siding with the plaintiffs and expressing the viewpoint that these people were lawfully in the country and therefore they couldn't be discriminated against. So I asked Margaret about that. I said, look, let me quote to you from the OLC memo justifying this, because after much justification, they come down on deferred action, and I'm going to quote here. Quote, deferred action arguably goes beyond such tacit acknowledgement by expressly communicating to the alien that his or her unlawful presence will be tolerated for a prescribed period of time. In other words, even OLC is recognizing that this is a little bit different. This difference is not, in our view, insignificant, but neither does it fundamentally transform the deferred action into something other than what? This is where Margaret is arguing it's really nothing more than anything else, other than an exercise of enforcement discretion. That's Margaret's argument. As we have previously noted, deferred action confers no lawful immigration status, provides no path to lawful permanent residence or citizenship, and is revocable at any time in the agency's discretion. What happens in this area is not only lawyers, but judges don't understand the terminology. So, for instance, so many people refer to illegal immigrants. They're not immigrants. Margaret, correct me if I'm wrong, but if they're not here lawfully, they're, quote, aliens. The terminology is extremely important. The district court in New York, I think, is messing up the difference between being tolerated to be here and being lawfully here, and that is significant. This defendant is looking at a 1981 action in which they are likely going to lose in a class action and be hit with attorney's fees, among other things. So these are not insignificant consequences. Now, one of the attacks, this is my second point, one of the attacks that's going to be made on the president's action, which, as Margaret said, it was not an executive order, it was an action, is that this is not an interpretive rule, but is in fact a change in policy where he is interpreting, where he is subject, or the agency is subject, to public notice and comment requirements under the Administrative Procedures Act. And it will be well for states to attack the executive action on that ground, because after all, the president did say that what he was doing is an action to, quote, change the law. And this is where the disagreement is, and I think John focused on this very well. At some point, it's not merely executive discretion, it is lawmaking. And that's what is going to have to be decided. If it is lawmaking, it is something very different. My third point has to do with the inability of the immigration services to do what even they recognize the law requires. What do I mean? Well, we know from Margaret that there have not been, and she's right, not been sufficient resources for the agencies to do everything that supposedly they're supposed to do under the law. Well, under the DACA, deferred action, they're supposed to take individualized consideration on a case-by-case basis. And then, if someone wants to the authority to work, that is supposed to be on a case-by-case basis to show that there is, quote, economic necessity, close quote. Given their department's resources, there is no way that they can give what the law, even under DACA, requires in terms of the individualized considerations. The reality is people are going to be passed through with no individualized consideration at all. Moreover, the president is talking 4 or 5 million people, but it has not been noted that at the about a month or so before all of this came out, there was a pre-solicitation notice that the Department of Homeland Security was looking for cardstock and other things to print 5 million cards a year for 5 years to a total possibly of 34 million. There is no way that the administration can do what is required on an individualized basis, even if everything else is supposedly justified. Thank you.
Hi, this is John Yu, and I just want to say I'm still waiting for the best part of Margaret's Thoks presentation when she was supposed to quote me in her defense. So I look forward to that part. But until then, let me just make two or three points, and not to repeat what the other two Johns have repeated. First, I want to say I agree, and I bet most of us on the call agree with the president's policy objective, and that is to prevent the deportation policies, deportation laws from breaking up families where one of the children is an American citizen or a permanent resident alien. But the, you know, obviously the question is whether that decision should come from a congressional enactment or by a president's order. And also I think we probably all agree that Congress has the plenary power under the Constitution over immigration, and that's something that goes back all the way to Supreme Court decisions from the 19th century. And I think we probably all agree that the president has two broad powers here that would give him some ability not to enforce act of Congress. The one that I think was raised by Margaret and John's discussion of the Emancipation Proclamation is whether the president has to enforce unconstitutional laws. And I think while the Supreme Court's never actually definitively ruled on that question, I think, at least I would, and I hope many people agree, that the president doesn't have to carry out laws that themselves violate the higher law of the Constitution. But that's not at stake here. Margaret and the president and no one else here is claiming that immigration laws are unconstitutional. So it would have to be the second ground, prosecutorial discretion. Does the president have authority to refuse to enforce every law in every case against every violation because he doesn't have or she doesn't have the resources available? And I think all of us would agree that the president has the discretion as the chief law enforcement officer to decide where to allocate limited resources, even if Congress doubled or tripled the budget, I'm sure, of the Immigration Service or the IRS, the president still couldn't ensure 100% enforcement of the immigration laws or the tax laws. The question here, to me is, and I think, let me just put to the side, I think it's been accurately this, I don't think the immigration laws themselves allow exactly for what the president has done here. I think it's interesting, if you look at the OLC opinion, which has been referred to, and this is an opinion that just came out 2 days, it was issued at the same time as the order, but it's dated November 19th, 2014. The government, the Justice Department, doesn't claim there's actually a statute here that really authorizes this. Their claim is that it's like, kind of like a Dames and Moore versus Reagan claim. It says, well, this is a very complicated area of law. They identify 5 policies that Congress passed about deferred action which are close to or similar to this, where Congress has shown a desire not to break up families. And they say, so they're effectively saying, well, in this lacuna, in this gap, why can't we fill it in because it's similar what Congress has done. Now, I think the problem with this argument, and look, as Margaret pointed out, I'm one of the big defenders of presidential power, particularly in foreign affairs. It's domestic affairs, I think, where the power of the president is more limited, is I don't think the president can say under his discretionary authority over law enforcement that to allocate resources, I'm just not going to enforce the law against an entire category. So I think the president can say, there are some cases which have higher priorities than others, and there are some that are where the money that we would invest in resources for prosecution have a better return than others. But I don't think the president can use prosecutorial discretion to say, I just refuse to enforce the law against roughly half the people that it applies to because I in a category that I define, and in that category, basically no one is going to be subject to federal law enforcement. Notice this is not what the Justice Department opinion actually approves. I actually think the policy that President Obama announced is much broader and is much more problematic than what the Justice Department thought it was approving. Because the Justice Department says, I think they're close to right on this, they say, look, the president does have the power to say, look, you have a lot of factors to consider when you enforce a case, and the president can certainly say this factor is an important one and should be emphasized by law enforcement officers, but he can't say to the exclusion of all others, because that would be tantamount to abdicating your authority to enforce the statute altogether. And that's I think that would be a much more defensible policy than the one the Obama administration issued, which would say, well, 5 million out of the 11 million people who are subject to deportation are not going to be deported, almost basically regardless of the other circumstances. I think that goes too far. And I like the tax example Margaret used. I've been actually floating it since this first came up 2 years ago. Suppose President, let's say, Ted Cruz in 2017 were to say, I want to cut taxes. I want to have a flat tax in the country of 20%. Now, Margaret's right that you couldn't have enough IRS agents to enforce every tax law and to go every tax cheat. But suppose President Ted Cruz were to say, anyone who just doesn't pay above 20%, no matter what your tax rate is, I'm going to tell the IRS not to go after them. Everybody will get a deferred action on their failure to pay federal taxes. And then effectively he's rewritten the income tax laws to create a 20% flat tax. I think that would be equally an unconstitutional use of prosecutorial discretion. And so let me just close quickly with just what could Congress do in response, because I think that's a very interesting question. I don't think this is really something that relies on courts. I do take issue with one thing Margaret said about there's no court decisions, there's nothing, we don't have a lot of law here to think about in terms of constitutional law. I think the other branches have to interpret the Constitution for themselves, and I think Congress is entitled to reach its own constitutional view on this program, and it's entitled to take countermeasures in response. I think that they could pass a law, of course, although President Obama will surely veto any law. Congress, I think, could launch a lawsuit. Well, I don't think Congress could launch a lawsuit. I agree with Margaret, there's no likely standing there. But I do think a lawsuit can be brought by the states. We haven't talked about it yet, but there was a case called Massachusetts versus EPA, which the Supreme Court decided a few years ago, where the court said states had standing to sue the Bush administration for failure to issue a regulation under the Clean Air Act about global warming. A very similar, I think, situation to here. The Bush administration was alleged not to be enforcing the law and not issuing the regulations it was supposed to. And the court said that a state there, Massachusetts, could bring suit because the waters might rise someday if indeed global warming happened, and Massachusetts might lose coastline. Seems to me a state has a much better claim to standing to challenge this policy, particularly states along, particularly states which have high levels of illegal immigration might have to spend more resources. Of course, Congress can do other things. It could also cut funding in various ways. Doesn't have to be for this policy or this program. It could just be to cut funding on other presidential priorities to get its ways. It could refuse to confirm nominees or all nominees until it gets its way. But I think the ultimate remedy is going to have to come from a new president, because one thing about an executive order that makes it extremely vulnerable, and I think actually puts immigrants who take advantage of this policy in a bad spot, is that since it's not by statute and not by valid regulation, the next president could easily just remove this policy, and all those people who stay in the United States and have start incurring expectations that they're here legally in some way could be just as subject to deportation in 2017. But I think that's when this policy really will get decided one way or the other. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, before we go, I was just going to say, Margaret, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to the last three speakers. But I just want to tell our audience, after Margaret responds, we will open it up for questions, and we should have about 15 to 20 minutes. So be prepared. We will open it up for questions. We'll have you press star and the pound key. So be coming up with questions now. But before we do that, I want to go to Margaret Stock and give you a few minutes to respond to a few of the things that were said by the last three speakers.
Okay. First, I do have to go into some of the details of immigration law because a lot of things were misstated. There's a big difference in immigration law between a lawful status and having permission to be in the country lawfully. They're two different things. And lawful status is completely different from lawful presence. I know that probably is going to come as a shock to people, but if you're an immigration practitioner, you know the difference. And there are agency memos dating back decades that talk about the difference between a lawful status and lawful presence. Deferred action is not a lawful status, but it does allow a person to be lawfully present in the United States. And that's the issue, John Baker, with the court case that I think that people didn't understand, was that you can be lawfully present and authorized to work and yet not have a lawful status. And that's what you are if you've got deferred action. Deferred action is not the DREAM Act. The DREAM Act gives people green cards, permanent residence, the ability to enlist in the military, the ability to become American citizens, so forth and so on, an unrestricted right to work that can't be taken away from you. Deferred action does not do that. Deferred action means we could deport you, but we've decided to temporarily defer your deportation. And, oh, we're going to let you work because we don't want you to be out there trying to, you know, beg on the highway or whatever. We're going to let you work to support yourself so we don't have to pay for your support. You're not going to be eligible for anything. You're not going to get a green card. You can't become a citizen. You can't vote. You have no lawful status, but you're lawfully present in the United States. And that's a key distinction in immigration law that I think, if, unless you're a practitioner, you wouldn't understand the difference. John Eastman quoted correctly the statute that says the attorney general is allowed to decide who wants to, who gets work permits. Unfortunately, John Eastman did not mention that 8 CFR 274 little a, point 12, C14 says one of the groups of people who are allowed to have work permits are aliens who've been granted deferred action. So it specifically says, and it's been in the law since 1987, that people who have deferred action are allowed to get work permits. In fact, I've been getting work permits for my clients with deferred action for 20 years. It's a very common thing. You would apply for deferred action at the local immigration office. They would give it to you, and then they would allow you to apply for a work permit. Been in the law a very long time, statutory. You know, Congress can repeal it if they want, but it's definitely in there. This is not a categorical suspension of the law that everyone, you know, claims is happening. But if it is, that's happened before. And I can point you to the Cuban memos. Cubans have been categorically exempted from being deported since decades now. And there's even a memo from 1999 specifically saying that Cubans who are unlawfully in the United States, we're not going to deport them. In fact, we're going to give them all work permits and not let them, they don't even have to pay for it. Okay. So there have been categorical suspensions of the law before. This has happened repeatedly. It just never got publicity, and we didn't have presidents claiming that they couldn't do it before. People say, oh, dear, you know, Crane v. Napolitano, the court ruling there. Well, it doesn't matter if the court threw the case out on jurisdictional grounds. It's not a holding anymore. There's no case. The case got tossed out. So we don't have a binding holding from a federal court saying, concluding ultimately that there's anything wrong with what the president did. People are complaining because there's no interpretive rule. Well, I guarantee you that they're going to be putting things in the Federal Register. The only thing they did on November 20th was issue a bunch of policy memos. And the last time they did that, it was followed by Federal Register, APA, official, you know, here's a form, notice and comment, go ahead, emergency rulemaking. They're going to, in the future, be doing the things that they say they plan to do. And that's one of the issues with this. Many of the things that were announced on November 20th haven't been done yet. Most of the things you can't apply for yet. There was just a preliminary announcement that this is where we're heading. We're going to be publishing a rule. There's going to be a form in the future. We haven't done that yet. You can't apply yet, but this is the plan for the future. So John Eastman, John Baker, there will be a Federal Register notice, I'm sure, in the future with some of these things. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that. That will be coming. The Danes and Moore argument, I do think they're trying to head in a Danes and Moore direction, and it makes sense to do that. After all, Youngstown wasn't the end of the road when it comes to interpretations of presidential power. Youngstown is where everybody points, but Danes and Moore further gave the executive branch additional authority. If you read, you know, the trail of cases, that's a further interpretation of the Youngstown test that gives the president more authority. There is a tax amnesty going on right now. I mean, you can go check out the IRS web pages. The president is not enforcing the tax laws categorically for large groups of people, giving them a chance to come forward and file their taxes, even though they should be fined. They're, you know, getting basically, or criminally prosecuted, they're getting a free ride if they comply with the amnesty program. So they have been doing that. As far as the arguments that, you know, they can't afford this and so forth, case-by-case adjudication, they do a case-by-case adjudication with these cases. That's what happened 2 years ago. They require the individual to pay a user fee, which is substantial, and to file a form and to go get biometrics done and provide evidence and answer questions. And there's a whole individual adjudication of each person's case. People do get denied status. Many people found out they were likely to be denied status and didn't apply under the program. So they estimated originally they were going to have 2.1 million applicants, and they only got around, you know, less than a million so far because people thought they weren't going to get approved for it because of the case-by-case adjudication that goes into the system. People are also making a big deal about this card business. You know, that was a routine renewal of a federal contract for cards, and the upper end of the contract simply called for the potential for a surge, only because it's a long-term contract and Congress has been talking about passing immigration reform. So when the federal government renewed the contract for the cards, it wanted the contractor to have surge capacity. It didn't say in the contract that they were actually going to have to produce all those cards. They just had to have the ability to surge to a higher level if Congress passed legislation that would require more cards. There's no need for any more green cards with this presidential action because nobody's getting a green card through this presidential action. I'll stop there.
OK, Can I go first? As I told you, no matter what you say, Margaret has very good detailed specifics to go against every argument, and that's why she's so valuable in understanding how to refine the argument. But it still comes down to, I think, the point that John Eastman made. And it's really a kind of a difference between law and equity. It is one thing to go on a case-by-case basis, and it's not clear to me, despite what you said, Margaret, that it really is the kind of individualized consideration that the law contemplates. And moreover, on the work authorizations, economic necessity, I mean, I just don't see that that de facto is happening. But at some point, when you give so many equitable dispensations of the law, there is no more law on that point. The exception becomes the rule. And that's what has always historically been the fight between law and equity. And I understand why DHS has done what it's done over the years. And it's done things in terms of interpretations and memos, et cetera, that people didn't, except practitioners, paid attention to. Now people are paying attention to it, and they're saying, well, wait a minute. The department has gone way beyond its authority at this point, and it's built exception upon exception upon exception. And even OLC understands that this is something new. And at this point, the argument needs to be engaged as to, is this really presidential discretion, or is it, as the president himself seems to say, it's new law?
And this is John Eastman. I want to take issue. Margaret, I did cite the regulation, and I specifically said the regulation allowed for the issuance of work authorization. But then I went on to say that the regulation has to find some statutory hook for it to be authorized to do that. And I found the read for the statutory hook to be so unbelievably slim that it's not sufficient to authorize that regulation. And if it were as broad to authorize that regulation, then it's an unconstitutional non-delegation of power to the president. And you didn't take up either of those issues. I also want to counter something else you said, that none of this is going to lead to anybody getting green cards or citizenship status. One of the things we've not talked about yet, because it kind of was done late September under the radar, was operating pursuant to statutory authority under the Title 10 dealing with the armed forces. The Secretary of Defense issued a blanket authorization to hire unlawful aliens based on his determination that such enlistment was vital to the national interest. Now, you know, we're in the middle of force reductions in a number of the services, so the notion that of the 60 million men and 58 million women who are eligible to serve in the military services, we can't seem to find enough to fill out the ranks when people are being terminated from their jobs in the military is beyond preposterous. But that determination that was kind of sent out under the radar by the Secretary of Defense allows any of these unlawful aliens to enlist in the military because the Secretary has determined it to be vital in the national interest. And on day one from that enlistment, they are eligible for immediate citizenship. This has been an overlooked part of this debate, and I think it's rather significant. I think it's part of the overall plan here. And again, I think it's a lawless use of this prosecutorial discretion claim to confer lawful status, not just lawful presence. And you know, and again, I take issue with that as well. But that's what's going on here. And we're talking about 5 to 10 million or more people at the end of the day being able to acquire a lawful status as a result of these actions.
John, you're wrong. I think you completely misunderstood what happened on September 25th, 2014. I hate to break it to you. What the Secretary of Defense did was simply say that people with deferred action, which is not a lawful status, are eligible to enlist into the military under the MAVNI program, which is limited to 1,500 people per fiscal year. Formerly, the MAVNI program was only open to people who both had a lawful status and were lawfully present. Now it's open to people who have deferred action for childhood arrival status, but, you know, don't have a lawful status. They can only get in if they are doctors or they speak a strategic language and they otherwise meet all of the military enlistment requirements for the MAVNI program, which also includes a single scope background investigation, which none of them can pass. So actually, nobody's getting into the military, so you don't have to worry about that.
Well, we already had the MAVNI program. This was broader than that.
No, it wasn't. Well, that's all they did. Go read the memo. They said the DACAs can enlist if they can qualify for the MAVNI program, and none of them can qualify, so they can't get in. And there's not a single DACA who's enlisted in the military under that program, not a single one. There's no DACA who's a doctor because none of them could attend medical school until this fall when Loyola let seven of them into the first medical class.
Hey, this is John Yu. I don't want to pick on Margaret, regardless of how much fun it is. I just have one other separate point that I think is tangential to this is if the president is able to do this, and you know we're arguing about what type of benefits that the other benefits will accrue to people who come who can stay in the United States in this program, given the way President Obama has interpreted other laws, Obamacare, welfare, education laws, and we can go on and on. What's to prevent President Obama from saying, well, now that these 5 million illegal aliens are getting deferred action, why can't he say, and I also feel now under my authority, under the welfare laws and the health care laws, that they should be entitled to receive full benefits under those programs, even though statutes don't specifically authorize it.
Well, they're barred from
getting under his approach, I don't see what the limit is, because he could just say, this is not immigration law, really, it's really his... he's going to trigger, but I think it's a similar approach to interpretation. He could say, well, the statutes don't prohibit it. Congress never said
Well, they do prohibit it. The statutes do prohibit them from participating in the Affordable Care Act.
But he could say, well, it also requires employers to have to provide mandatory insurance within 1 year of passage of the law. sort of pretty clear, and
well,
he just said, well, I'm not going to enforce that one, and because I don't, and his claim wasn't as unconstitutional, and his claim there wasn't even, I think it wasn't even as strong as the one that Margaret's making about immigration law. It wasn't, well, there's different statutory policies, and we're sort of fitting it in closely to things, other things. He just said, I don't think it would work well, right? If we did that, then the statute's going to be difficult. And he could say, well, why can't he make up a similar reason to, override the prohibitions in other statutes, too, and just say, well, I don't think the statute will be fully effective as I would like it to be unless we extend it, no matter what Congress said in those provisions.
Well, I think that is an issue, but, it's a Chevron problem. We have to deal with that pesky Chevron case out there that lets agencies interpret statutes where they're ambiguous.
Yeah, the thing that bothers me about what he's done in the other areas is that it's not, it's not ambiguous. I mean, I think Congress just says, the healthcare law just says, you have to have, all employers have to provide insurance within a date certain. And he just said, well, I'm waiving the date certain because I think it creates difficulties for other parts of the statute. It's kind of like the argument he's making. Right now, we can talk about, that's all maybe another phone call about the subsidy, the subsidy case that's at the Supreme Court now, where he's saying I can rewrite the statutes or pick and choose which ones, because I think I have a vision of what's a more rational statute than what Congress did. And I think if he had that approach here, he could, I think, give a lot of benefits that people might be worried about to this, very large group of people that Congress did not, could not anticipate.
Well, you do have a point about the healthcare in that they are barred from healthcare exchanges per se, but if they work for an employer who provides healthcare, the employer is required to provide healthcare for all its workers, and they're working lawfully because they've been given work permits by the government, so they can get healthcare through their employers even if they can't participate in other provisions of the Affordable Care Act, which are barred to them by law.
But, Margaret, I understood from something I read yesterday that, in fact, there's an incentive for employers to hire DACAs because they don't have to give them the health care.
Yeah, well, I think it depends on whether you're an employer who's required to provide health care or not.
Well, it was my understanding that whereas you...
Yeah,
there is an argument.
Yeah, people are debating this right now, but it was clear Congress decided to exclude certain people from the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, so it doesn't apply to everybody. People can't go on exchanges and
But again, if it's a matter that's debatable, as we've been debating, then it comes back to John Yu's point If the president says, well, you know, I mean, even though Congress said that, there's a debate.
Well, no, I think, you know, one of the problems is I don't think we're here to debate the provisions of the Health Care Act because that's a whole nother teleconference. But they did not, the folks with deferred action do not get all the benefits the lawful permanent resident or U.S. citizen is entitled to, including they don't get all the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. So,
but one of the interesting things is that they get more benefits than those people who are here legally. That is, if you come in on a valid visa, you know, your certain student visas and other visas, you can't work. They're here legally and they can't work. So why are people who are here, quote, not in a lawful status, why should they be allowed to work?
Well, students can work if they go to the section of the register and comply with the rules in there. In fact, one of the memos that was issued on November 20th is to expand the ability of foreign students to work in the United States. That's one that's not getting discussed, but the executive branch has decided to grant more students work permits under the same authority that we've been discussing here. The Attorney General is allowed to give work permits to anybody he wants as long as he publishes it in the Federal Register, and I'm sure they're going to be doing notice and comment rulemaking on that, and lots of students will be getting work permits.
But Martin, you still haven't taken up the non-delegation. If the Attorney General has, or the Secretary, has completely unfettered discretion, where is the intelligible principle that authorizes that complete delegation of lawmaking power? There is none. And we haven't had a non-delegation case striking down a statute in a long time. But this one has absolutely no intelligibility to a principle that would confine or constrain or direct the exercise of that discretion. That's kind of core violation of the non-delegation doctrine.
Right. Well, Ronald Reagan signed this law into the U.S. Code when he was president. And
there's not a single point in the debate in 1986 by the proponents or the opponents that I've been able to find, anybody referencing that this four-word phrase gave unfettered discretion to the executive branch to give out work authorizations contrary to the intricate stat provisions in the law otherwise, just on whenever they wanted to. Not a single word from it. And you can bet that the strong opponents of that 86 Immigration Reform and Control Act would have been raising that from the rafters if that had been anybody's intent to give that kind of unfettered discretion to the executive.
Well, one problem is going to be that the executive has been exercising the right to announce in the Federal Register who can work, and they've been doing that since 1986.
And we're now focusing on it. So that, you know, the fact that they've been acting unconstitutionally for 25 years doesn't let them acquire it by adverse possession, the right to permanently exercise lawmaking power without an act of Congress actually confining their discretion in some intelligible way.
Well,
yeah, but if you go back to
find
out that a longstanding executive practice that has gone unchallenged can sometimes become the law if you go read the case closely.
Well, all right. This is Christian. We've actually reached the end of the hour, but I just want to see how many of the four of you could stick around for a few minutes to take a couple questions and who's got a hard stop.
I could stay about 10 more minutes.
10 more minutes.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we take a question or two from the line? In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. And a reminder, please do try to keep your question as short as possible, and please do make sure that there is a question included in your statement. Looks like we've got a bunch going, so we'll go as quickly as possible.
Hi, this is Josh Blackman. I thank you all very much. I think that both John and two Johns, he's done a good point. The OLC memo specifically says that the policy does not specify, quote, what counts as a factor that would deem deferred action appropriate. It leaves the officer with substantial discretion. In terms of DACA, I've looked at various numbers. Only between 1% and 3% have ever been denied. In fact, steps were taken to make it easier to grant, specifically waiving fees, making the background checks not as invasive. It seems that every juncture, this is designed to be something of a rubber stamp. I wonder, Margaret, please enlighten me, how do you define individualized discretion when virtually everyone who applies and meets the criteria set by the president will get the deferred action? What point is there actually is this discretion on the ground by the agents?
Okay, well, I think that's a very good question because it points up something that I don't think people realize. The president first didn't set the requirements for DACA. It was Janet Napolitano laid them out, and then the agency further developed a form and a FAQ online and so forth. And one of the reasons why there's such a low denial rate is because people aren't applying for it if they're not eligible. The agency was very clear to lay out all the criteria for, you know, eligibility for the benefit. They didn't want to waste people's money because these individual adjudications are very expensive. And so what they did was they laid out the criteria, and lots of people went to see lawyers, and the lawyers told them, you are not going to get your application approved, so don't apply. So the small denial rate is not particularly surprising, given that it's a very complicated application to file, and most people are going to see a lawyer or some type of skilled legal practitioner to see if they qualify. And those folks are vetting the cases and telling them, as I've told people, you're not qualified, don't bother to apply, they're going to deny your case. Lawyers also shared initial results of the first cases that came out, and when people started getting denied, all the word went out all over the place, and everybody knew you're not going to get approved if you, you know, have this category or this characteristic. So people just didn't apply if they didn't think they were going to get it.
But Margaret, if you announce that 4 million people are going to get it, 4 million out of 11 million people, that sends a signal to the bureaucrats to change your standard for reviewing these things. Once that gets known, then the applicants will increase.
No, because this is the thing I don't think people understand. Those are wildly exaggerated estimates. You know, they said 2.1 million people they thought were going to get DACA, and that's not what ended up. It was less than a million people applying. And, you know, I hear these numbers. I don't think anywhere close to the number that's being flung around is going to qualify, because I've looked at the criteria that they're planning to apply, and the vast majority of folks who are unlawfully in the country don't meet those requirements. The standard one is, you know, you've been in the country a really long time. You have to have a kid who's born here, or you have to have a lawful permanent resident child. And hordes, millions of immigrants in the country don't have children, so they're just knocked out of eligibility. They can't apply for this. The other one that is getting a lot of people is you can't have any DWI offense at all, not a single DWI. You're disqualified. So if you have a drunk driving offense from 40 years ago, you're not qualified for this. You know, there's a whole bunch of other criteria that are going to be developed. They haven't actually published anything allowing people to apply for anything yet, but there's no way that that many millions of people are going to qualify for this based on what happened.
What stops them from changing the criteria or loosening the proof for the criteria?
Well, what stops them is they announced generally what they were going to be, and, you know, they would have to loosen that with some future executive action. But, you know, I don't see why they couldn't. I think
right.
The president has authority when he doesn't have enough resources to deport 12 million people. He has authority to decide that he's going to defer the deportation of lots of them. You know, Congress only gives him money for $400,000 a year for deportation. So you've got 12 million people in the country unlawfully. You've got money to deport 400,000 of them. There makes perfect sense that you would prioritize the deportations and focus on the people that are going to be your top priority, the drug dealers, the murderers, rapists, sex abusers, you know, so forth. And that's what he says he's going to do. He's also saying that he's going to focus on drunk drivers. So anybody who's got a DWI conviction is going to be a priority, too, for deportation.
Or you can do what we do with the tax code, which is we set priorities to go after the bigger tax scofflaws, but we don't give a categorical exemption for people that fall under a certain level. The IRS brings certain cases against those folks as well. That leads to a voluntary compliance system that makes it possible to run the tax system despite the shortage of resources. And something similar would be a much more lawful compliance with the constitutional obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. What this president has done is given a categorical exemption, and the small percentage of those who have applied for DACA and did not get it was because they didn't meet the criteria. But anybody who meets the criteria is getting it. That's a categorical exemption, no matter how many times Janet Napolitano used the phrase, do this on a case-by-case basis.
her memo and Lee Johnson's memo, Jay Johnson's memo that followed up on it, mentioned case-by-case basis, but then they specifically tell the line officers in the Immigration Services that they shall give this deferred action to anybody that meets the criteria. That's not case-by-case. That's categorical, and that's what presses the limit on prosecutorial discretion.
But they've been doing that for decades and decades, and Congress has actually asked to do that. You know, the Cubans have been getting a categorical exemption since the 1950s.
Let's see if we can get we've got about 5 minutes left in our extended time. Let's see if we can get to at least one more question, through one more question.
John Eitzman with the Foundation for Moral Law in Alabama. I've heard only about one or two passing references here to the presidential power to pardon, and of course under Murphy versus Ford, the court said that that power is broad and could be exercised even before any charges were brought. I'm wondering if you think that the power to pardon has any relevance to this discussion.
This is Margaret Stock. Yes, I do believe it does have relevance. I think the president's lawyers haven't told him about that power yet, but certainly he could do what Jimmy Carter did and pardon people. He does have the power to pardon people for civil and criminal violations. Most immigration violations.
But there's a difference. There's a difference. You pardon somebody so that they're no longer eligible to be prosecuted for the crime they committed. But you don't go out. Jimmy Carter pardoned the Vietnam draft dodgers. He let them all come back from Canada. But he didn't give them honorable status in the military as a result. That's the difference. Not prosecuting somebody is prosecutorial discretion. Pardoning them means you're not going to ever be able to prosecute them for that crime they've committed. But you don't go the additional step and give them a permanent lawful status, continue to break the law. That's the difference, and that's where the president here has crossed the line.
Well, he hasn't given them any permanent lawful status at all. He's saying he's going to give them a status that is not a lawful status. It's deferred action. He's giving it for a short period of time. He's kicking the can down the road to whoever gets elected in the next presidential election. It's up to that person to decide whether to continue this policy, to seek legislation from Congress, to rescind the policy. They can do whatever they like on day one, inauguration day. But there is no definite permanent status being given to anybody under this. There's no lawful status being given.
He is giving work authorizations, and as I've said several times, based on the flimsiest of statutory authority, that if the statute means what he claims it means, violates the non-delegation doctrine. And that's the kind of the crux of the dispute.
Professor Baker, Professor Yu, any thoughts on the pardon power?
Well, I agree with what John Eastman said.
This is John Yu. I don't think the pardon power would stretch this broadly, and I also agree that there's a difference, I think, between, because a pardon effectively does it, what wipes out what any criminal activity you could have been convicted of. You have a clean record, right? You have the right to own firearms and vote, I believe. But this is not, I don't think what the president's doing here, it's almost like what we don't do in the Justice Department, didn't do in the Justice Department, which is kind of it's like a declination to prosecute. It's almost like a pre-pardon pardon. And so I think this goes too far.
Well, it's a continuing offense.
It's a tough question.
Too. It's a continuing offense. You can pardon them, but they've then committed another offense after the pardon because they're still here unlawfully.
Yes, exactly.
That's not a criminal offense, though.
Well, a civil offense.
Civil violation.
It's still a violation.
And they're not.
I mean, as in a matter of the original understanding, it's not clear to me that the pardon power included civil offenses at all. So, I mean, clearly, if obviously it applies to criminal, and then I think but if you went back and looked at the original understanding, it's not entirely clear to even cover civil cases. But
right. Well, we probably need to have another one on that. But so far, the president has not attempted to exercise this pardon power. However, it does give some texture to the constitutional arguments about what kinds of power the president has in the prosecutorial discretion arena, since the Constitution does give him this pardon power, which is not given to Congress specifically, it's given to him. So it is quite interesting. I think we probably have to have another debate on that one.
Fantastic. Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. We've reached the end of our extended time. I want to thank all four of our experts for participating in an extremely lively and intelligent discussion today, and thank you all to our audience for sticking with us this late. You can find the recording of this podcast on our website, as well as all of our other Teleforum conference calls posted shortly, where you can download or stream them. Until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.